It is nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station here in beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where it is currently 55 degrees. They are saying a light rain is falling out there. The Weather Service is calling for a 70% chance of rain today. Out at the airport, they have northeast winds to 5 miles per hour and 10 miles of visibility. Just a 40% chance of rain tonight and tomorrow. Coming up on the Midday Report, Kodiak was Senator City last week. You'll hear more about that. And culturally important objects are being returned to tribes as a result of a new round of federal grants. That and the devil's thumb. What is it? And who wants to climb it? Those stories and more after national headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. The National Weather Service says virtually all of Los Angeles's daily rainfall records have been broken after Tropical Storm Hillary made landfall in Southern California. NPR's Julia Simon has more.
The intense storm that formed in abnormally warm waters off the coast of Mexico brought record-shattering rain to Southern California. San Diego got more rain Sunday than it's ever gotten in a recorded summer day. Desert communities east of Los Angeles, like Palm Springs, saw an average half a year's worth of rain in a single day. Roads are still flooded and blocked off across the region. Emergency officials have described water rescues from cars stuck in flash floods. But the Los Angeles mayor said today there was no recorded loss of life there. Mayor Karen Bass thanked Angelenos for listening to warnings and staying off the streets. The LA fire chief said the fire department is still monitoring highly saturated hillsides for possible landslides. Julia Simon, NPR News, Santa Monica.
President Biden is on his way to Maui nearly 2 weeks after wildfires swept the Hawaiian island. He and the First Lady are to take a helicopter tour of the burnt-out areas. FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell says the president is committed to Maui's recovery.
I continue to provide the president updates on what the response efforts are, and he always says, what else can we do? And we continue to move more resources in. I think based on the updates and the communication that I have had with the president, he is satisfied with our response, but he will always push us to make sure that we are doing as much as we can and bring in more resources if needed to support this community.
Officials say at least 114 people died, and that number is likely to rise as crews continue to search through the debris. Lawmakers in Tennessee are convening for a special session on public safety today, called in response to a deadly school shooting in Nashville in March. The shooting led to gun reform protests inside the Capitol. From member station WPLN, Blaise Ganey reports.
This morning, the Southern Christian Coalition formed a human chain around the Capitol building as they prayed for lawmakers to be compassionate during the upcoming session. Pro-gun control advocates and faith leaders are calling on the General Assembly to restrict access to guns. Chaplain Deron Johnson of United Church of Christ led one of the several prayers.
Fill each person in the streets beyond this place so that your energy might rise up and help us and help them create change.
When Tennessee's Republican governor issued the proclamation for the special session, he left little, if any, room for legislation related to making it tougher to buy guns to be filed. For NPR News, I'm Blaise Ganey in Nashville.
On Wall Street, just before the close, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 36 points. The S&P 500 was up 30 points. This is NPR News.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor llama al 907-481-2400.
For KMXT, I'm Terry Haynes. Alaska's senators brought Senator John Boozman of Arkansas to Kodiak last week. Boozman is the ranking member of the Senate's Agriculture Committee. And he's on tour to see what farming looks like around the country. As KMXT's Brian Benoit reports, the Kodiak visit was a chance for him to see what food security looks like in Alaska.
The three senators arrived on the island on Wednesday, and one of their first stops was the Kodiak Harvest Foods Co-op. They asked staff and volunteers some questions about how the co-op supports local farming and walked around the store to see what locally sourced goods were available. Senator Dan Sullivan says visiting smaller communities keeps public figures grounded as they write policy from their offices in the Capitol.
Co-ops and locally grown produce strengthens communities and helps us with our food security, which a lot of, you know, senators are unaware how kind of vulnerable we are in a lot of ways with regard to food security.
Sullivan says one of his priorities is to add fisheries considerations to upcoming farm bills. He says he wants fishers to have access to programs in a similar way to farmers when markets aren't in their favor. Senator Lisa Murkowski says farming in Alaska looks extremely different compared to the contiguous U.S. It's usually on a smaller scale, and the state has a shorter growing season. She says the Kodiak stop of the tour is their way of introducing Senator Boozman to Alaska's fisheries.
When we're talking about food, we should be talking about seafood. So what are we doing to incorporate seafood into the farm bill? So it's a great opportunity for him to see firsthand what this means. We're going to be looking at mariculture operations, kelp, oysters, and just the potential for growth across our state.
Senator Boozman says fisheries are a unique industry to serve and understands the Alaska delegation's sentiment about providing more opportunities for fishers.
We're also going to be talking to the fisheries. You know, they have lots of problems, and fisheries are kind of unique. They don't really have a home. You know, they're divided amongst all of these committees, and so we'd like to help out and see what we can do in regard to that industry.
Boozman says his Kodiak visit was brief, but was glad to meet with so many people and try to relate with them in his tours.
It's very different than Arkansas, but I think the people are very much the same. You know, these are hardy people that are very individualistic.
The senator from Arkansas also met with seafood processors while they were on the island. Boozman even visited a farm in Yuzinki, a village of fewer than 50 year-round residents, to show him what agriculture looks like in some of the most remote places in the state. Boozman is also planning to visit the Alaska State Fair before leaving. In Kodiak, I'm Brian Benoit.
Objects that are culturally important to tribes in Alaska, like ceremonial masks and drums, are scattered throughout the collections of museums across the globe. A new round of federal grants will help two tribes and two museums in the state bring some items home. Coast Alaska's Angela Denning has this report.
Anthropologist and explorer Ted Banks collected items from the Aleutians in the 1940s. Some were human remains.
Like human bones and skulls and jawbones and things like that.
Chris Price is the CEO of Unalaska's tribe. The Kowlungan tribe of Unalaska is receiving about $15,000. The money will help them bring back items from the Museum of the North at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
Lots of different archaeologists and explorers over time have come to Alaska, and they, you know, removed sacred objects, including human remains.
The Kowlungan tribe plans to bring some of the items back to their island, and others will stay at the museum for research. The returned remains will likely receive a ceremonial burial, depending on what the tribal council decides. Carter Price writes grants for the tribe. He says culturally, it's very important to get ancestors' remains back to their homes. He says museums and others are more understanding of that now.
There has been a shift with some of these organizations with wanting to return items. I think there's the recognition that housing some of these items isn't morally correct. So we're seeing more work with the tribes in trying to get the artifacts back.
Alaska's grants are part of $3.4 million awarded to tribes and museums throughout the country through the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, or what's called NAGPRA. The NAGPRA law was passed by Congress in 1990. The Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska is receiving two federal repatriation grants totaling about $144,000. They've been awarded similar grants over the past three decades and have worked with museums in California, Minnesota, Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania, and Maine to return items. So far, they've repatriated more than 140 objects.
They were either bought by the museums or donated from individuals that acquired them, sometimes illegally.
Desiree Duncan oversees the NAGPRA program for the Tlingit and Haida tribe. She says they repatriate and store the cultural items in Juneau and then loan them out to clans for memorial parties. The tribe has over 36,000 tribal members and several clans. The grants help elders and clan leaders travel to the museums where they look through archive rooms and identify items that belong to their people. Duncan says it's very moving.
Looking at the objects and just seeing them come to life and being with the clan leaders and elders, and it's just a very powerful experience.
Would you say that it's like sadness because it's been kind of in a sterile environment like that, or is it more of a happy reunion?
Well, I would say both, and it's very emotional. You go through different emotions while you're in there.
She says they just repatriated a killer whale shirt from the Minnesota Museum of American Art to Juneau, and they're in the process of getting several more items back: a Wolf Clan mask, a ceremonial mask, shaman figure, blankets, a box drum, and totem poles that were taken from communities across Southeast. Duncan says they are grateful for the funding, which has increased over time, but it's not enough to do all the work. She says Tlingit and Haida is always looking for more opportunities to bring their culturally important items back home. Other grant recipients in Alaska include the University of Alaska Fairbanks and the Aleutic Museum and Archaeological Repository in Kodiak. Reporting for Coast Alaska, in Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
Devil's Thumb sits just across the water from Petersburg, a monolith of ice and granite. Until recently, the mountain had never been climbed by someone born and raised in Petersburg. Kyle Knight reached the summit after a lifetime of watching the mountain, dreaming of the climb. KFSK's Hannah Flohr has the story.
Devil's Thumb rises to 9,000 feet above sea level, part of the boundary mountains of the Stikine Ice Field. Mountaineer Dieter Close has spent more time exploring the Thumb than anyone else. He came to Petersburg to climb it in 1980 and eventually made Petersburg his home.
Like my son said, Petersburg wouldn't be the same without Devil's Thumb. You know, and I think for everybody, we see this beautiful thing. It's like inspiring. It's daunting. It's aberrant. And it just instills this wonder in climbers and not.
In cloudy, misty southeast Alaska, the peak isn't visible most of the time. So it's shorthand. When people say, you can see the Thumb, that means good weather, blue skies. The mountain's remote location and extreme conditions make it notorious among rock and ice climbers. It's been summited fewer than 50 times since Fred Becky first climbed it in 1946. The classic Eastern Ridge is sometimes referred to as the easy route, but that's only in comparison to the icy northwest face, which remains unclimbed. Three people have died in the attempt. To locals, the Thumb is as much a part of Petersburg as the rain and the smell of fish in summertime. That's part of the reason that 35-year-old Kyle Knight wanted to climb the mountain.
I think that's what makes it so special or significant to me, is that that's a peak that's been dominating the skyline from a very young age. And, you know, it's totally striking. I know that everybody has some sort of a relationship with that skyline.
His interest started in middle school when he found an old climbing magazine from the 70s in his parents' library. It was an account of a climbing party's first ascent of the North Ridge of the North Face of Devil's Thumb.
Was just totally enamored with that story of their adventure and the landscape.
But when Knight was young, and even after he started climbing in his teens, summiting Devil's Thumb seemed more like a dream than a realistic goal.
I felt like that was sort of the realm of the world-class alpinist, and a challenge and a risk level that I wasn't going to be able to develop the skills to be comfortable with.
But the skills came. Knight became friends with people who had climbed Devil's Thumb. After high school, he moved to the lower 48 and climbed constantly. The dream became a stated goal. It would take another 15 years to achieve the goal. That's partly because the best time to climb the mountain is May through August, when there's less chance of avalanches and rockfall. Knight is a fisherman and spends summers in Bristol Bay. But this year, a close friend with lots of experience on the mountain was visiting Petersburg. They decided they would attempt the climb in August after Knight returned from fishing. Even in summer, storms can make an ascent of Devil's Thumb impossible. But the pair lucked out with a tight window of good weather within days of Knight's return. They took a helicopter to base camp where they spent the night. At about 7 a.m., they roped up and began their climb of the direct east ridge. Knight says he often tried to block out the view on the way up.
It's scary. So by focusing just on the moves themselves, you can avoid that fear.
They reached the top around dinner time.
I totally felt satisfaction. But also I know that getting to the top is only halfway because you got to get back down and you never want to feel so satisfied that you lose that sense of focus.
Knight says the summit is a boulder about the size of a van.
The actual top of it is just big enough for one person to sit astride with 6,000 feet of exposure down on either side below your feet.
They spent about 2 minutes taking in the view and snapping photos. It was 2 a.m. before they were back at base camp. Knight says their slow speed could have been due to his training, or lack thereof. He had a very specific training regimen in the months leading up to the climb.
Bristol Bay sockeye salmon fishing. Lots and lots of crawling in and out of the engine room.
But it took longer than expected for another reason. There's a lot of newly exposed rock where in the past there had been snowfields. That rock hasn't had time to settle, which means it's loose and dangerous. Knight says the descent in the dark was a risk that he was comfortable taking just once.
Yeah, I did it once. I don't really want to do it again.
But trying the thumb again, Knight says he gives it a solid maybe.
A big part of wanting to do it is looking at it for all these years, and now I can look up there and know that I have been up there.
Veteran climber Dieter Close is thrilled that Knight summited the mountain.
He's the first person that grew up in Petersburg and climbed Devil's Thumb. In my mind, that's the beginning of a legend in Petersburg.
One thing is for sure, it's not the last mountain Knight will climb. He plans to keep fishing every summer and climbing the rest of the year. In Petersburg, I'm Hannah Flohr.
The U.S. Assistant Secretary for Health, Admiral Rachel Levine, traveled throughout Alaska last week to consult with tribal health organizations and to learn more about the unique public health challenges of the state. In an interview as the trip was wrapping up, Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra asked her about what stuck out from her time in the state.
I was here to listen and to learn about the public health challenges in Alaska and discuss potential solutions. So what stood out was trips to rural Alaska, to Nome and to Savunga, Kotzebue, Kayana, Utyavik, and meeting the people there, meeting the healthcare personnel there, but also just being in those towns and villages.
And I know you had meetings with tribal health organizations. What did you learn during the consultation?
We learned about the great work that they are doing, both in their towns, but also the villages that they serve, but also heard about a lot of the different challenges of doing that. You know, I think that they have made amazing use of telehealth in those areas and are just very innovative and creative. But there are difficulties in providing care for sometimes acutely ill people. I mean, stabilization and then transport throughout the state, challenges in terms of impacts of the weather. Some of the specific issues that we heard about were the impacts of climate change on the way of life in the towns and villages. We saw the impacts of climate change on traditional food sources.
In Alaska, we've seen overdose rates rise with the prevalence of synthetics like fentanyl. Are there solutions that you wish more states would use?
There are no quick fixes here. There's no magic bullet. I think it is really looking at different prevention strategies, which I know is being done in Alaska. I think the harm reduction strategies are very important. That can include naloxone. Naloxone reverses opioid overdoses. I think that there are opportunities for more medication for opioid use disorder, such as buprenorphine. There's still a lot of stigma associated with that it's a crutch, and we don't view it as a crutch. Medication for opioid use disorder is like we use medicines for other disorders. The medication, again, is not a crutch. It's not a cure. It's a treatment, and it can be a very, very powerful treatment.
I've heard from leaders in the field that eating disorders in the state have increased over the COVID pandemic, especially for young people. What do you wish Alaskans knew about eating disorders?
Sure. Eating disorders, particularly in young people, are treatable. And the vast majority of young people with anorexia, bulimia, et cetera, they completely recover. And I think that that's not widely known. I think that people tend to think it's a lifelong disorder. And it can be. It can become a chronic illness, but the vast majority do not. We have certainly seen an increase in eating disorders throughout the country during the pandemic, you know, really associated with a lot of the mental health challenges that young people have faced. There are not enough eating disorder treatment programs and professionals available. You know, I think that early recognition is really important. So recognizing the signs and symptoms of an eating disorder, because the more entrenched it gets, the longer it goes on, then the harder it is to treat.
Often in the U.S., mental and physical health are considered separate. Obviously, there's lots of intersections. Can you talk a bit about that?
The integration of physical and mental health I've always found very important and interesting, and that's what drew me to adolescent medicine in the first place. And I think it's so important now, especially coming out of the pandemic, because the physical and mental health challenges that we're seeing across the nation and Alaska are all related. Your mind and body are connected. And I think that that's one of the keys to medical care and public health in the future.
Support for KMXT comes from GCI. GCI is a participant in the Affordable Connectivity Program, providing qualifying Alaska households entry-level broadband internet. More information at gci.com/ACP.
China cuts rates, but not by much. I'm Henry Epp with the Marketplace Minute. Stocks in China fell as the country's central bank cut a key interest rate in an effort to boost demand for credit, but policymakers surprised investors by not changing another rate used to price mortgages. The country is facing financial risks in its real estate sector. President Joe Biden is headed to Hawaii today to view damage from wildfires that killed over 100 people. Hundreds more are missing. The administration has authorized over $8 million in federal assistance so far. Leaders of five emerging economies meet tomorrow and will consider expanding their group, but the BRICS nations, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, are divided over whether to admit more countries to their alliance. I'm Henry Epp with the Marketplace Minute.
Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Monday. It is the 21st day of August, the year 2023. The sun rose today at 6:46. It will set again at 9:37, which will give us 14 hours and 51 minutes of daylight, a loss of 4 minutes and 46 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record high temperature for this date was 76 degrees, set in 2020. Our record low was 42, set in 1963, and then again in 1986. It's currently 55 degrees in Kodiak. It is lightly raining. Out at the airport, they are showing northeast winds to 5 miles per hour, and they have 10 miles of visibility. A 70% chance for rain for the rest of the day with mostly cloudy skies, high near 58, southeast winds to 10. And a 40% chance of rain for tonight and tomorrow. Overnight low tonight of 52 with east winds becoming completely calm this evening. Let's check in with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and their latest announcement.
Hello, this is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Kodiak with Kodiak Commercial Salmon Fishery Advisory Announcement number 35, date issued 10 a.m. on August 21st. There will be a 72-hour extension to the current commercial salmon fishing period from 6 p.m. Monday, August 21st, until 6 p.m. Thursday, August 24th in the following areas. In the Northeast Kodiak District, the Eastside Kodiak District, the Humpy Deadman section of the Alitak District, and the Southwest of Fognak and Northeast of Fognak sections of the Fognak District. The following areas will close to commercial salmon fishing as scheduled at 6 p.m. Monday, August 21st. The Duck Bay, Iziut Bay, northwest of Fognak and Raspberry Strait section of the Fognak District, the Cape Alitak, Alitak Bay, Mosier Bay, and Olga Bay sections of the Alitak District, and the Mainland District. There will be a 30-hour commercial salmon fishing period from noon Wednesday, August 23rd until 6 p.m. Thursday, August 24th in the following areas in the Duck Bay section of the Afognak District. As previously announced, the Inner Karluk section of the Southwest Kodiak District is open to commercial salmon fishing until 6 p.m. Tuesday, August 22nd. The following areas are open to commercial salmon fishing until further notice. The Outer Iakuluk, Outer Karluk, Sturgeon, and Halibut Bay sections of the Southwest Kodiak District and the Northwest Kodiak District, except for the Uyak Bay and Inner Uganic Bay sections, remain closed. Closed waters are reduced until 6 p.m. Tuesday, August 22nd in the following areas at Karluk Lagoon's exit channel terminus at the ocean shoreline. Closed waters are expanded until further notice in that portion of the southwest Afognak section of the Afognak District within 1/2 nautical mile of the beach near the stream terminus of Molina Creek, stream number 252-105, between 58 degrees 10 north latitude and 58 degrees 11 north latitude. Cost recovery fisheries began in Katoy Bay Special Harvest Area on August 5th. And fishing opportunities in the Duck Bay, Izhuit Bay, Inner Katoy Bay, and Outer Katoy Bay sections will depend on the ability of the Regional Aquaculture Association to meet cost recovery needs, and all cost recovery information may be obtained by calling 486-6559. Until further notice, within the Kodiak area, only that portion of the northwest and southwest Kodiak districts south of latitude of Cape Kuliak, king salmon 28 inches or greater in length may not be retained by purse seine gear in the commercial fishery and must be returned to the water unharmed. Other closed waters are shown in the Kodiak area salmon statistical chart and detailed in commercial salmon fishing regulations. And statistical charts, harvest strategies, and commercial salmon fishing regulations are available at the Kodiak Fish and Game office. And, of course, the most recent salmon fishery information may be obtained by calling the department's 24-hour recorded phone at 486-4559. Thank you very much. Good luck fishing. This is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
And the Chignik and Karluk rivers continue to have high levels of escapement. Yesterday in the Chignik River, 11,751 late-run sockeye were spotted going up the river. They have now totaled 805,470 total sockeye for this year. That compares to 817 in 2015, which was the last highest year. In the Karluk River, they saw 8,440 late-run sockeye yesterday coming up the river. That gives them 425,503 sockeye escapement so far. That's almost double the 213,804 at this time last year. Mariners, here's your weather forecast for Marmot Island to Sitkanak out to 15 nautical miles. Southeast 15 today, seas to 4 feet. Variable 10 tonight with 3-foot seas, and variable 10 tomorrow with 3-foot seas. Over in the Shelikof Strait, variable 10 for today and tonight and tomorrow. 2-foot seas today and tonight. 3-foot seas tomorrow in the Shelikof. There will be a Board of Education regular meeting tonight at 6:30 p.m. in the District Services Conference Room, which is number F140 of the old high school wing. Meeting agendas and packets for the meeting can be viewed on board docs. For more information, contact the Interim Secretary of the Board of Education at 907-486-7550. Also today at 3 p.m., the Health Facilities Advisory Board will be having their regular meeting. That will be happening in the Borough Assembly Chambers, again at 3 p.m. Tomorrow, the Parks and Recreation Committee will be having their regular meeting in the Borough Conference Room at 6 p.m., and the Solid Waste Advisory Board meeting that was to have occurred on Wednesday has been canceled. That's been pushed to the next Wednesday. They are still working on Lower Erskine with asphalt milling and paving. For today, they will allow local traffic, and the Senior Center will have curbside meal delivery between now and 1 p.m. Flaggers will be stationed at the intersection of Mission Road and Lower Erskine Avenue, as well as within the work zone. And for tomorrow at Lower Erskine, that road will be closed all day. The Senior Center will have bag lunches available at the Griffin Building parking lot tomorrow. Flaggers will be stationed at the intersection of Mission Road and Lower Erskine, as well as within the work zone. When a detour is being utilized, a flagger will be stationed at its Mission Road intersection. Things happening at the library include the Summer Reading Challenge. Activities continue at the library. Now is the time to finish up your reading and attend activities to complete the challenge. The program ends September 1st.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 2 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.